Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimpera, host of the Public Policy Channel, and we are joined today by Peter A. Swenson, who is the author of Disorder, A History of Reform, Reaction, and Money in American Medicine from Yale University Press. Peter, welcome. If you would start us off by telling our listeners a little bit about who you are and how it is you came to this particular book project.
Oh, okay, sure. Thanks, Stephen. Thanks for inviting me to do this. So I'm a political scientist, so to speak. I've taught at Penn and Northwestern University before I came to Yale. I come from a medical family, which explains a bit of my interest in the medical politics. My father was a professor of medicine, a pulmonologist. My mother was a nurse and a public health nurse. But I was very political as a young age. It was the Vietnam War, civil rights, Watergate. I wanted to be an investigative journalist, a muckraker. I never got the sense that medicine was in any way political from my parents, although they were liberals and so forth. I've come sort of full circle as I started teaching, mostly and writing about economics and politics of labor, social insurance, the welfare state in the U.S. as well as Sweden and Germany. The focus on, to the extent it was on health care, it was about the health insurance, and as most political scientists and sociologists on the subject, the focus was on the distribution and financing, but not so much on the organization and delivery and costs and in the quality of healthcare. What are we paying for, and not just how we're paying for it and who we're distributing it to. And then there was the question of the costs, huge rising costs. As Warren Buffett called healthcare in America, it's a hungry tapeworm. It eats up 20% of the GDP. Long story short, I started teaching on the political economy of healthcare, and I came across a book I have to give credit to Michael Millenson. He wrote a book called Demanding Medical Excellence, and it was really eye-opening for me as well as my students about the problems of deficient quality in healthcare. And so I started looking at the quality issues. And so in the end, my book is about three big issues: quality, equality, and economy. And it explores the relations between those. And you might call it a kind of trilemma. Choose two, equality and equality, but it'll be damned expensive. Equality and economy, it may not be very high quality. There are huge trade-offs, and how do you resolve that? But the book is about tracing an arc of medical politics and how those three issues, quality, equality, and economy, figure in the politics.
So when we think about the histories of those kinds of questions, healthcare in the United States and how we account for its difference. The traditional accounts will often foreground the role of the American Medical Association. I'm thinking of Paul Starr's Social Transformation of American Medicine, which may be familiar to some listeners. But one of the things that I think is particularly fascinating about your book is that you bring to us a history of both the AMA, the American Medical Association, and the medical profession more generally that is, I think, fair to say, not covered in those more traditional histories. So I wonder if we might do this a little bit chronologically. Tell us a little bit about the state of the medical profession, say, prior to the progressive era, and then we'll work our way forward and talk about some of that history that may be less familiar to people. So before we get to 1900, give or take, what does the medical profession look like, and is there any sort of organization of it as we would recognize today?
Okay. Let me just, it's interesting you brought up Starr. My original title or working title was The Political Transformation of American Medicine. And he was a social transformation. And he covers very much the same period, but there's very little politics in it. Extremely little, and very little illuminating about the American Medical Association. And also, I critique him quite a bit in the book. He sees the AMA as this the conservative organization it was and is through the lens of the present. He sees the historical AMA through the lens of the present. And what I learned, to my surprise, was that the AMA around the turn of the 20th century was a profoundly progressive organization. Astonishingly progressive when you think about what it became. What was the progressive AMA? Well, what is progressive medicine? What is progressivism in medicine? Well, first of all, the AMA was part of the larger progressive movement, and it overlapped with the larger in personnel and people and issue concerns with the overall larger public health movement, and that's gone by the 1920s. So, what is progressive medicine? Prevention before treatment. Public health should be a central mission, not a sideshow. Rational therapeutics, that's the term they used at the time. Evidence-based treatment. Equity, equitable distribution of quality care, quality rational therapeutics. And extremely important in progressive AMA was avoidance of conflicts of interest, a very arm's length and even hostile relations with the drug industry. A search for order and progress, to use Wiebe's title on the progressivism. Interesting on an aside, the AMA is just virtually absent from the historical literature on progressivism. The role of science and expertise and a really important theme and issue in my book, both pre and post reactionary turn, was the role of alliances with lay forces, with lay people, lay organizations, and in the post 1920s, the alliances, the character of medico-political alliances changed radically. So, a couple more points about the big issues in the progressive era was drug reform. I mean, one of them was drug reform, and the relations with the drug industry were murderous. They were hostile, and the AMA was a key factor behind the passage of the first Food and Drug Act in 1906. And by 1938, the big reform. The AMA was missing in action, and then in 1962. So the 1938 brought a regulation of drug marketing to ensure safety, not yet efficacy. Efficacy comes in 1962 with the Kefauver Harris amendments to the Food and Drug Act. And the AMA was against the reform that called for, believe it or not, against the requiring quality, random, quality double-blind drug trials for safety, for efficacy as well as safety. They were against that. They thought that doctors don't need help deciding what drugs to use on efficacy grounds. They could figure it out for themselves in their individual practice. The other big issues are public health and creating a national department of health like other countries had. And we didn't get a national cabinet level Department of Health, the Health Education and Welfare until 1953. Well, the progressive push for the Department of Health failed because of opposition in part from the drug industry. After the 20s, the AMA stopped pushing for a national system. And they even were very crabby about creating one in the HEW in 1953. Medical education, a battle against for-profit medical schools. Think Trump University medical schools. The vast majority of medical schools were for-profit proprietary institutions. And finally, there was the issue of compulsory health insurance, which was a big battleground inside the MA and then ultimately was part of the story. Not the big part other people say, but the battle for the over about compulsory health insurance was part of set in motion the reactionary turn up in part a backbench revolt, if you will, against the progressive AMA.
So why don't we work our way toward making sense of that progressive term? So you've talked about this organization that really is not folded in traditional progressive era histories of the many kinds of coalitions that were forming around issues specifically for state and federal regulation and the ways in which we should be thinking about the central role that the AMA played in a number of those fights. But as you've pointed out here a couple of times now, by the time we get to 1920s, that genuinely progressive American Medical Association starts to shift in its politics and its policy preferences in the way that it functions. So maybe talk us through that. So what happens and why? And then let's look a little bit at what the effects of that reactionary turn are for efforts at health policy in the mid-20th century.
Sure. So it wasn't a shift. It was a dramatic break. The internal politics of the AMA was in turmoil because a lot of the progressive reform agenda made a lot of rank and file doctors as well as elite doctors mad as hell. To give you one example, the medical education reform, the AMA was secretly instigated the Flexner report of 1910. And that's not known. I write about that. It meant shutting down a lot of the medical schools, really abysmal, horrible medical schools that the rank and file doctors went to, and they had their diplomas on their, you know, on their office walls. And public health, some were against public health because that meant less typhoid fever meant less
bad for business.
bad for business. Drug reform. So in my book, I talk about how each of these big issues created enemies inside the profession while creating friends, making friends with lay forces outside the profession. And the reactionary turn, it was sudden. It meant a turnover, a massive turnover in who led the leadership. People were virtually booted out, the old progressives, replaced by younger people without public health interests or backgrounds. And there was a kind of schism with the public health movement afterwards. and create the kind of, so recently we've, with COVID, we look at a public health system that's underfunded, in disarray, chaos, and after the reactionary turn, those the relationships with the public health world between medicine and public health was one of confrontation, suspicion, creating the disarray that, and I'm using words here that the Institute of Medicine used in 1988 to describe the, so the reaction turn meant increasing and then friendliness and ultimately dense entanglements with the drug industry and handing the question of rational therapeutics over to profit-making enterprise. And then the change in the alliances of the medical profession away from progressive liberal forces to conservative. And that included, and one ought to be surprised, the tobacco and cigarette interests of the southern states. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the AMA becomes a member of the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, the American Farm Bureau. It was just a radical shift and sudden around 1924 is the big change. And so it was a dramatic turmoil inside the AMA, as I said. I think that's kind of part of the answer to your question.
Yeah. Let's talk. I'm thinking particularly about the influence of drug industry money and tobacco industry money in shaping the way the organization thinks about its politics. One of the things that you point out, among many things that I did not know, is that in fact member dues are not the main source of revenue, at least at this point, weren't for the AMA. Is this about more than money, or is this the funders of the organization have particular interests and this is the institution pursuing their financial interests rather than their oaths as medical professionals?
Good questions. I want to say one thing that we could maybe circle back to at the end was the AMA was a incredibly powerful force after the 1920s. And so I write a chapter on medical power politics. And here, that's where I focus, you know, a lot of it is a critique of Paul Starr. And the AMA exercised power partly in alliance with lay forces, moneyed interests, using a lot of propaganda but also the AMA was a very coercive and punitive organization over the medical profession itself and suppressing dissent and punishing dissent. So I talk a lot about the mechanisms of you know, the AMA couldn't have exercised its conservative power without exercising power over the profession. It was the iron law of oligarchy, and I add a corollary: the iron where you say organization and you say oligarchy, and I say, well, say oligarchy, and you're saying misrepresentation. Okay, so drugs and money,
and tobacco and money,
and tobacco and money. Boy, the investigative muckraking journalists, I'm forgetting their names right now, called it the weirdest alliance one could imagine, something about the weirdest political alliance one could imagine. Well, a big part of it was the Southern Democratic powerful Congress people, senators in control of power, powerful committees, were an essential allies in the opposition to national health insurance, to compulsory health insurance, and they really needed that those allies, and they even went so far as to They were AMA was part of one of the merchants of doubt. Some people, readers might be familiar with that. How industry one way industry fights regulation is to instill doubt about the need for it and whether science is settled on the question of, for example, does smoking cause cancer? Does smoking cause cardiovascular disease? And the AMA played this role of as a merchant of doubt for many years, and even was opposed to civil litigation against tobacco companies. And one of a former CEO testified that in a deposition in an important case that where the plaintiffs lost was that he didn't like the word cause. Connecting smoking and cancer because there are so many people who smoke who never get cancer. Well, that was just a fatuous, specious argument. It's just laughable to anyone who understands how medical causation, you know, what causes things. And so that's a shocking part of the, but the bigger part in the end was the drug and device, medical device industries, mostly the drug industry, but the device, medical device industries, biotech, the medico-industrial complex. So I depict, and I think that the AMA, organized medicine in general, is part of the warp and weft of the medico-industrial complex. The AMA, the organized medicine, the house of medicine, so to speak, is the warp, the vertical whatever, and then the money, the weft weaving together. And you need a warp and a weft for this medico-industrial complex. And I think we people don't see organized medicine as you know, essential. They're the organized and medical organizations and increasingly, especially specialty organizations, are in a very real sense the selling agents of the medical, the drug and device industry. So, I mean, it's very intricate. All the work moving parts of that are, you know, I could get into the weeds on a good number of them, but let me just to give you some figures on this. U.S. healthcare is about 20% of the GDP. That's massive. Okay, and just a moment. I'm bad at just pulling up numbers out of my head. Okay, so pharma and med tech, $1.5 trillion a year. That's a huge chunk of the $4 trillion the U.S. spends on healthcare. Pharma plus medtech, $1.5 trillion. Healthcare, $4 trillion. Okay, that's a vast amount, and a huge amount of that trickles down through organized medicine. You brought up, and this is really important, membership dues of the AMA and over 100 specialty societies that are voting, have voting rights inside the AMA. Membership dues are 15 to 20% typically, and in a way, so you read their yearly reports, and that's kind of deceiving because so much of there's. You become a member of AMA and you get lots of benefits, monetary side benefits of being a member of the AMA, which costs the specialty societies would cost them money. So it's all shrouded in secrecy. The yearly reports do not give you a picture. And I'll bring up, there's a reform element now in the post-90s AMA, but they're held kept in the dark about they're kept in the dark. Let's put it that way. And we could come back to the reform inside the MA and a kind of new progressivism.
Well, I think that seems like the sensible place to go now, right? As you observe that the, you know, part of the context for what you were just pointing out, right, is that we spend more than any other rich democracy on the planet than healthcare on healthcare and get less for it, right? We've got higher infant mortality rates, lower life expectancy rates, higher rates of morbidity and mortality around all kinds of issues, yada, yada, yada. There are all kinds of different ways that different people have thought what we do about that. But certainly most of the explanations for why we fail point toward some of what you just gestured at, right? Is the enormous opportunities for private profit making in the United States that don't seem to exist in the same way in other places. And most accounts of 20th century efforts at fixing that problem put the AMA pretty squarely in the center of that story. They're almost always one of the key players in ensuring that we don't get more healthcare coverage offered to more people at lower costs. As you've suggested, you see signs that maybe things are turning around, right? 2010, the Affordable Care Act, the first instance in the modern period in which the AMA was not in outright opposition. What do you see changing, and should we be hopeful about a possible future in which they are less powerful in opposition to better access and price controls on healthcare?
I'm not very optimistic about about organized medicine. So it's interesting. There are a lot of medical reformers now in the medical profession, and one thing that's really new is that it used to be a powerful code of silence that the organized medicine imposed on the medical profession. Not only don't you criticize your fellow physicians, but you don't criticize medical care in any way into the public. And it was very oppressive. And that's changed. There are many, many prominent, influential medical people who are, and the vast majority of them do not join the AMA, although they're members of their specialty societies. But they basically have written it off as just irrelevant. And there are dozens and dozens of books by physicians criticizing the American medical disorder, as I call it. And they either typically they don't mention the AMA. It's just irrelevant to them. They feel like it's so, I don't know, it's irrelevant. Or worse, and I think their attitude is you're likely to get reform out of organized medicine as likely as getting gun control reform out of the NRA. It's not going to happen. But my position is this is wrong. This is the wrong. So there are two kinds of reformers. They're the insiders in the MA, and there are a significant number and growing number who are trying to push it in a progressive direction. But then there are those who say these are just enablers. They're passing very admirable resolutions and policies but they're just paper, and they give the AMA cover, you know, for looking progressive. But when they spend their $20 million a year in lobbying funds with 50 professional lobbyists, they're not pushing for reforms that public health reforms, for example, reforms for climate action, control of antibiotics, dealing with food insecurity and food deserts and obesity. Fossil fuel pollution, you know, these are, they pay lip service to these things, but the AMA does. And the specialty societies don't even bother. I understand the critics who say the reforms inside the AMA are enablers, but the people who write off the AMA are also enablers in that they let this, the the one of the most powerful forces in American healthcare just go about its business. And so I argue for the critics of the AMA to join the AMA and help it wean itself from its, what I call its commercial, it's on commercial life support. And organizations run on money, but they're not running on membership dues. But writing it off, writing this powerful force off instead of reforming it is enabling it too. And so maybe on an optimistic note is, look, the AMA gave 1 year $2 million to this coalition of insurance companies, drug industry, hospitals, for-profit hospitals to fight against a single payer system. Well, that didn't sit well with a lot of delegates to the AMA's House of Delegates, and there was a vote that went 47% calling on the AMA to drop its opposition and to excuse itself from this coalition, to drop its opposition to single payer, not to support single payer, but just drop its opposition, because the AMA boasts of being the voice of unified voice of American medicine. Well, that's BS, and that it leads at the forefront of public health. More BS. But so there is an element, younger, often female. They're not the sole male independent practitioner that were dominated in the AMA, and so the medical profession in the ranks is changing dramatically, and they could be a potential force for change through the AMA, through organized medicine, not trying to go around it, which is a pretty it isn't working.
I am going to suggest that on that reasonably optimistic note is a perfect place to end. This is the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and you've been listening to Peter Swenson talking about his new book, Disorder, A History of Reform, Reaction, and Money in American Medicine, new from Yale University Press. Peter, thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Stephen.